1521 hours GST, IPS Valiant, hyperspace. Priority burst transmission from HMS Unfathomable, one of Lou Durgo reported from the comm station. Looks like that briefing they promised us. Utina nodded. Okay, let's have it. After a moment's pause, the main viewer changed from the tumult of hyperspace to a non-humanized Cheltari Seleucian. Slightly to Utina's surprise, the man wore no identifiable part of a Royal Navy officer's rather elaborate old-fashioned uniform, at least on the part of him that could be seen from mid-chest up. Instead, he had on a slightly grubby gray crewneck sweater, to the shoulders of which were affixed the black shoulder tabs of a U-ship captain, and a peaked cap like WDF officers wore, similarly soiled and a little bit crushed. Trident Command, Priority Gold Crypt Traffic from HMS Unfathomable, Lieutenant Ivar Merkrech commanding, he said. We've completed a preliminary survey of the Earth Alliance naval forces currently besieging Tau Ceti IV. This task force appears to be made up of ships drawn from the Earth Force Navy 3rd Fleet, Centaurus Sector Command. The image switched from Merkrech to a slightly fuzzy long-scan visual of a warship in Earth Force charcoal gray. As you see here, Merkrech's voice continued, their flag is a Nova-class battleship. We have positively identified her as EAS Clytemnestra. She's one of the latest Block 4 Novas, less than 2 years out of the graving docks at Lunarville 9. Tabbing through a sequence of images as he spoke, he went on, she's accompanied by 4 cruisers, 2 Hyperion-class and 2 Nebulas, a 3-ship Patriot-class destroyer squadron, most probably Deseron 14, the battleship's usual escorts, a Salyut-class aerospacecraft carrier, which we believe is EAS Komarov, and a Retiarius-class perimeter control vessel, which is what Earth Force calls interdictors. The image switched again, this time to the blocky, slightly awkward shape of a vessel clearly not intended to fight other starships. Accompanying the Naval Strike Force is this vessel, which we have identified as EMCS Suribachi, an Earth Force Marine Corps Surface Assault Vessel. Suribachi is the command ship of the 10th Surface Assault Corps, so we have some idea just from that what the opposition on the ground is going to look like. The screen switched back to Merkrech, looking grave. 10th SAC is a hardcore outfit, the kind of unit you send if you figure you're going to have to pacify a whole planet. We've watched them deploying dropships to every major population center on Tau Ceti IV. Most of their forces have dropped in Tau City, unsurprisingly, but they seem to be determined not to leave any side doors open. It's safe to assume Earth Force has a flag officer aboard Clytemnestra for this operation, but we don't have any intel on who that might be. Clytemnestra's CO is Captain Hannah Davidson, Earth Force Academy Class of 95, an experienced officer who commanded a cruiser during the pacification of Proxima Centauri a few years back. Assuming they haven't made any major personnel changes, 10th SAC is under one of the Earth Force Marines' hard chargers, Major General Westford Drake. He might be overall flag for the operation. He's senior enough. Cracking the first smile of the briefing, Merkrech added, "And no, before you wonder, I didn't know all of that ahead of time. I had to look it up after we ID'd the units involved, much as I hate to preempt any reputation this might give me for omniscience. That's all the information I have at present. We're undetected at this time. Once we finish transmitting this report, we'll slip back in and see what else we can learn before it's time for us to break off and report to the initial point for fleet rendezvous. Then we'll pass along whatever more we've learned. Clear skies, Red Group, and we'll see you at the IP. Unfathomable out." Utina sat back in her con and sighed as the viewer returned to a forward view of hyperspace. "It's not going to be one of the easy ones, is it, Miki?" she asked rhetorically. From the navigation and gunnery station forward, Miki Kaworu smiled and replied, "Has it ever been in you to do things the easy way?" Utina laughed. "Are you saying I have a reputation?" She got up from her con and went back to the situation table at the back of the bridge. Okay, Lou, let's have that map of Tau City. No plan survives contact with the enemy, but we probably should still have one when we get there. ''2300 GST, Babylon 6. Lieutenant Malcolm Reed clocked on for his security shift at 2300 hours, wondering why it was that, in all the centuries since organized policing had come about, no one had ever been able to work out a way to soften the impact of switching from days to the graveyard shift. At least everyone in the department had to take a turn at it, even Chief Garibaldi, who was due on at midnight. The chief arrived a couple of minutes late, but to make up for it, he was carrying two cups of coffee from the fancy little coffee stall on the Zocalo, one of which he put down on the duty officer's desk in front of Reed with a yawn. "Sorry I'm late," he said. "They're still dealing with the Tau Ceti thing upstairs. What have we got down here? Anything interesting?"
"You could say that," Reed replied with a dry smile. "Only one person in the cells right now, but he's one for the books."
He handed Garibaldi a datapad. "Got into a firefight down on Brown 21 this afternoon, and judging by the sector officer's report, wiped out about half of Dr. Salian's gang, including the good doctor himself."
Garibaldi's eyes went up as he skimmed the report.
"And we locked him up? That's the kind of service to the community that should earn a man a medal." He frowned, reading on. "Sosuke Sagara. Says he's a private security officer. Did his ID check out?"
Reed checked his own desk terminal.
"Affirmative," he said. "But he hadn't checked in with us when he arrived, and his weapons were undocumented. So whoever was duty officer at the time decided to let him cool his heels pending your personal assessment."
Garibaldi sighed. "Why do I even have subordinates?" he asked rhetorically. "Guess I better go talk to him."
"So," said Garibaldi pleasantly a few moments later, sitting down opposite Sosuke at a table in the security office's main interview room. "Sergeant Sagara, I'm Michael Garibaldi. I run security around here."
Sosuke nodded.
"I know," he replied. "Did you also know the plastic explosive and the knife you were carrying were illegal on this station?" Another nod. "They represented the absolute minimum I was willing to operate with in the field. I left all my ballistic weapons and heavier explosives behind."
"And yet, with just a toothpaste tube of plastique and a ceramic shiv, you took down the self-proclaimed boss of Brown 21 and most of his guys."
"Failing to do so was not in my mission parameters."
Yeah, I can believe that. And that girl you were protecting will have reason to be glad about that once she wakes up. That was some impressive work, particularly for someone your age."
"A wise man once said, 'It's not the years, it's the mileage,'" Sosuke replied calmly. Garibaldi laughed.
"Huh, true," he said.
Then, becoming serious again, he went on, "But you know what should have been in your mission parameters?" When Sosuke didn't reply, the security chief got to his feet, put his hands on the table, and leaned over the young man. "Checking in with this office when you boarded the station. My people tell me your credentials check out. If you're a legitimate PSO, we've got procedures for that, you know? You didn't have to sneak your kit through the checkpoint. Hell, you could have carried all the gear you wanted if you just bothered to let us know what you were here for." He sat back down, shaking his head. "That's the trouble with you mercs. Always got to go your own way, even when there's no damn reason not to play nice." Sosuke considered that, then nodded a third time, really more of a seated bow. "I apologize," he said. "I've been a covert operative in much more restrictive environments than this for a long time. Functioning openly is not my instinctive response."
Garibaldi glanced at the datapad on the table in front of him again, then looked up and met Sosuke's eyes with a leveled gaze. "My colleague Chief Odo of the DSM Campus Police concurs with that assessment," he said. "When my guys checked on your ID this afternoon, he reported that you pulled a similar thing with him when you first got to DSM. Well, up here, that kind of cowboy stunt is a little more likely to get you and your girl into a world of trouble." He stood up. "So you better see that it doesn't happen again. Anytime you come back to my station, this office had better be your first stop after the docking bay. Got me?" Sosuke blinked slowly at him. "Are you releasing me?" he asked. "I am," Garibaldi told him. "And if you're smart, you won't make me regret it. That might make me angry." He smiled slightly. "You wouldn't like me when I'm angry." Sosuke stood up, came to attention, and saluted. "Thank you, Chief Garibaldi. I won't repeat my mistake." Garibaldi looked slightly taken aback, as if he hadn't returned a salute in a long time. After a moment's hesitation, he did so, then said, "Okay, let's get you signed out. I assume you're heading to MedLab when you leave here." Sosuke nodded, following him to the outer office. "Affirmative. Miss Chittery is unlikely to be in any further danger. I believe her encounter with the criminal element of Brown 21 was a simple accident, but my place is with her regardless." "In that case, you'll need better equipment," Garibaldi mused. When Sosuke gave him a surprised look, he smirked faintly and said, "I wouldn't send one of my guys to guard a high-security patient without a weapon. Reed." "Sir?" Reed asked, looking up from his workstation. "Sergeant Sagura here needs some hardware. Issue him a Phaser 1. Knowing from long experience that there was absolutely no point in arguing with Garibaldi when he had that look on his face, Reed just nodded and went to the armory. Saturday, March 6th, 2410, 0305 hours GST. To say Babylon 6's executive officer was having a difficult, whatever the hell time of day it was to severely understate the point. The day before had been merely somewhat trying by comparison, just traffic for a wedding. No big deal. But tonight, the space assets of several militaries across the entire sector were being rapidly shuffled like a deck of cards, and guess who had to manage it all? Admittedly, she wasn't the only one having a hard day, and she would take directing all this traffic over what the chief of the IPO had spent all night and into the wee hours of the morning doing. Commander Susan Ivanova's skill set was extensive, but it did not reach to preventing a border skirmish, if that was what you could call the Tau Ceti incident, from sparking a Federation-fracturing civil war. "Commander," the voice of Bruce Corwin interrupted her train of thought. "Incoming ship from the Medigate. Telemetry indicates it's... a battleship?" He frowned, double-checking his readings. "No, wait. It's a battle carrier. Ikazuchi class." "Oh, what now?" Ivanova grumbled, and she turned her attention to the main viewer. Outside, she could see the gate arms maneuvering to the correct opening width, and the flashing lights proceeding along their length as the gate itself activated. Ivanova had seen quite a few starships emerge from the red-black whirl of metaspace by now, some of them hesitantly, some of them confidently, others with their guns readied in anger. This was the first time in her recent history, however, that she could recall seeing a starship exit the gate with intent. She wondered how their helmsman did that. The Ikazuchi in question, like its older sister ships, was a blocky, slab-sided vessel, long and narrow, with massive sublight thrusters sticking out the back end. These thrusters were going full burner, propelling the ship towards the station relentlessly. For a brief moment, Ivanova wondered if the ship was going to attempt something as foolhardy as ramming the station, but her concern was unfounded. As she watched, the carrier rapidly slowed, coming to a halt two-thirds of the way to the station. Now that it had stopped, she was able to see the ship's markings. A large WDF sigil decorated the sides of the starship near to its prow, but it was dwarfed by the much larger, inverse black triangle with a superimposed, stylized M that accompanied it. Now it was Ivanova's turn to be puzzled. What the hell is Mars Division doing here? Commander, the Veranda Elendil is hailing us. They're requesting permission to send over several members of their crew. Do they have anything more specific than that? They're here to see their daughter. Elsewhere, the daughter in question slept in Medlab. Well, that was something of a misnomer. Kaname Sterling's body slept, but her mind was going a mile a minute, destabilized by the after effects of post-neuroshock syndrome on a nervous system that wasn't quite human. Jumbled facts and information rippled across her mindscape while snatches of memory from her own life and of other people's floated in and out of her semi-conscious perception. Buffeted by the random currents of thought, it was all Kaname could do to keep some sense of self about her, and even then she didn't notice that for all intents and purposes, her self-image was naked. She had no idea of how long she floated in the faintly glowing blue-green hallucinatory expanse of her mind, processing thoughts that she didn't understand. A small part of her felt regret at the fact that she hadn't plumbed her father's mental inheritance further in the past, for if she had, would she have had better control over this entire experience? The rest of her was more concerned with just surviving the ordeal. She didn't want to be officially listed as crazy before she hit 21, after all. And then, suddenly, the tempo of the entire mindscape changed. No longer were the images and words coming haphazardly. Now they came in a tidal flow, roaring through her mind as she could feel the knowledge surging upon her as a giant towering wave that was sure to swamp her. And then, heeding some unknown instinct, she dove straight through it. The sudden calm that followed was perhaps even more overwhelming than the chaos that preceded it. She floated there on the tide of thought, a brief moment of utter tranquility that almost broke her heart to experience it. She could feel the sun rising in her mind, and she knew that, whatever happened past this point, it would be all right. With a smile on her lips and an old song in her heart, she was enveloped by the light. All this was lost on Mizuki Inaba, who was currently sitting at her friend's side in Medlab. She hadn't originally planned to come to the duelist's wedding of the year, not being particularly associated with this society, but she was never opposed to a good party with cute guys in attendance, and somebody other than Kaname had to help keep Sagara in line. The guy couldn't handle even a simple meet-and-greet down at DSM. Who knew how he would behave at a full-out wedding reception? But apparently he could handle himself in a scrap, which is why he was sitting at attention by the opposite corner, keeping watch over the room. Mizuki had never really bought into his line about being a soldier, and had been somewhat concerned that Kaname and Linze had swallowed it hook, line, and sinker. But given the fractured reports she'd gotten from Dean Montaigne when she and her friends had finally noticed that Kaname and Sosuke hadn't made it back from Babylon 6, she was starting to have her doubts about the whole affair. Mizuki had to force herself to suppress a shudder. The thought of what could have happened to her friend if Sosuke had not intervened. Well, it wasn't the kind of thing that a person particularly cared to dwell upon. Fortunately, as a distraction, the video monitor was on in Kaname's room. Unfortunately, it was currently tuned to one of the multiple news channels which were reporting the 14th hour of the crisis on Tau Ceti 4. This was unfortunate mainly because Network 23 didn't have anything much to report about said crisis at that point, since no reporters had managed to get into the system yet. Even Network 23's anchors could only stretch an extremely sketchy story for so long before it became obvious that they were just filling airtime until something happened. And Mizuki had stopped paying attention to the recaps of Earth Force's seizure of the planet, which had taken place the previous morning, after about the fourth iteration. In the corner of the room, Sosuke Sagara sat silently and watched everything at once without seeming to be looking at anything. At first, when he'd arrived after being cut loose from security detention at midnight, Mizuki had assumed that he'd taken up that position because it was close to Kaname's bed, which struck her as cute. Then she realized he'd done it because he could see both entrances to the room and the ventilation duct at the same time from there. She had initially found that slightly creepy, but when she reminded herself to filter her reactions through what she knew of Sosuke's rigidly military mind, she decided that it was still cute in a unique sort of way. "I'm amazed Earth Force was able to subdue a whole planet so quickly," she said, more for something to say than because she expected a reply. But to her surprise, she got one. "The Setiani were unprepared for a surprise attack," Sosuke replied. "They expected any application of force by the Earth Alliance would be preceded by the establishment of a diplomatic pretense, however flimsy, as did the IPO. If Earthdome's foreign ministry wasn't made aware of the invasion, that implies a rogue operation, albeit one sanctioned at the highest level. President Greeley exploiting his status as Commander-in-Chief of Earth Force to take action without the advice or consent of the Senate. He must hope to complete the reconquest before anyone can react, and then present it to the Federation as a military fait accompli. That level of brinkmanship is inconsistent with his record. That's why the Setiani and their defense coalition were caught so badly off guard." He folded his arms and assumed a look of grim satisfaction. "If I were a betting man, Miss Inaba, I would wager that Chief Griffin and his command staff won't make that mistake again." Mizuki blinked at him. Not only was that the longest speech she'd ever heard Sosuke Sagara make, it was a demonstration of such big-picture thinking that she had to take a few moments to digest it all. Then she said, "Wow, that's... I hadn't considered any of that." Trying to make a joke of it, she added, "And here I thought you were just a grunt." A soldier who can't understand the strategic ramifications of his situation cannot be 100% tactically effective, Sosuke told her. "I learned that lesson the hard way on Helmajistan." Mizuki might have pursued that line further. It was rare for Sosuke even to mention his past, much less allude to details of it. And after his little dissection of the cosmopolitical implications of Tau Ceti, she felt intensely curious. But her attention was abruptly diverted by a change in the status monitors attached to Kaname's biobed. The neural activity graphs, which hadn't been all that level to begin with, abruptly spiked, becoming chaotic enough that it triggered an alarm. The other monitors weren't doing so hot either. Whereas before they had been relatively calm, they started to oscillate more rapidly. Startled, Mizuki shot to her feet in concern. By the wall, Sosuke had also moved into action, coming to the opposite side of the bed. She was about to hit the call button to summon Dr. Bashir, but before she could do so, the graphs immediately calmed, lowering briefly to a nearly flatlined state, before rising again to what even Mizuki could see was a standard humanoid biorhythm. "What the hell?" she asked nobody in particular, clearly perplexed as she looked down at her friend. "What just happened?" "A very good question, Miss Inaba," replied Dr. Julian Bashir from behind them. He waved a medical tricorder over Kaname's forehead, then consulted its screen. "It should have taken her several more hours, a full night's sleep on top of the afternoons she'd already had, for her neuroelectrochemistry to stabilize, but here it appears as if her mind has totally reset, for lack of a better word." He looked at his readings again and smiled, his eyes twinkling. "Fascinating." Kaname stirred, blinked her eyes open, and sat up, only registering Bashir's presence when she reflexively brushed his restraining hand off her shoulder. "Easy now," the doctor said. "I'm not sure what just happened, but after the day you've had, I'm still fairly certain you shouldn't be moving around too much." Kaname rubbed at her eyes, then gave him a puzzled look and said, "What are you talking about? I feel fine." "Oh, hey, Mizuki. What are you looking so freaked out about?" "What am I? Kaname?" Mizuki blurted, feeling perversely indignant that her friend seemed to be perfectly all right after she'd spent all night worrying about her. "You got zapped with a stun rod, you've been asleep for 14 hours, and then your monitors all go crazy, and you just sit up, and you're all... what? Ah!" Hang on, 14 hours?" Kaname asked. "Seriously?"
"Very nearly," Bashir confirmed. "And I still need to get quite a few more readings before I'm comfortable with what you just did."
Kaname eyed him dubiously. As far as she knew, not having really registered that part of what Mizuki had just said, what she just did had consisted of waking up. But she let it pass and asked, "So it's, what, 3 in the morning?
"It's 0311 hours, Miss Chittery," Sosuke informed her without looking at his watch.
Seeming to notice him for the first time, Kaname passed swiftly through a remarkable set of emotional evolutions, all of which registered plainly to Mizuki. Delight, faint surprise, gratitude, embarrassment, uncertainty, and finally a sort of smiling nonchalance that was mildly but distinctly forced.
"Oh, hi," she said. "Have you been here all night?"
Sosuke shook his head. "I was detained by the security department until just after midnight. I've only been on post here since my release."
"Huh," said Kaname. "I'm a little surprised they cut you loose now that I think about it."
"Chief Garibaldi agreed that I was acting within my authority as your personal security operative," Sosuke reported. "His only objection was that I failed to notify his department of my presence aboard the station beforehand, an oversight I promised to rectify in future." Kaname smirked faintly, simultaneously tickled and nettled by Sosuke's unbending air of professional stolidity even after what they'd been through, and settled back on her pillow, remarking, "0311 hours, huh? When do you sleep, 007?
"Never on the firm's time, Miss Chittery," Sosuke replied without hesitation.
The response was the correct one, and yet so unexpected that it jerked Kaname back up from her pillow to turn and stare at him for a second in surprise. He looked back at her, his face its usual impassive blank, and then gave her just the faintest hint of a smirk of his own. She gave in and flopped back onto the pillow, laughing aloud, and then turned her head to regard him without sitting up again.
"Thanks," she said, her voice quieter and more personal. "I think I needed the laugh right now."
Sosuke nodded, his expression perfectly neutral again. "It's all part of the service, Miss Chittery."
"That is remarkable," Dr. Bashir remarked,
straightening from his examination of the bedside monitor panel. "This system's readings correlate with my initial tricorder observations. You experienced what I can only describe as a neurological restart. I've never encountered anything like it."
"Yeah, well, don't look at me. I was unconscious at the time," Kaname said wryly.
She trailed off, raising a hand as if for silence and tilting her head to listen for something nobody else could hear.
Mizuki blinked. "What is it, Kaname?"
Kaname's expression blanked for the briefest of moments, and then she looked up at Mizuki, Sosuke, and Bashir with clearing, worried eyes.
"It's my parents. They're here."
Ten minutes later, Kaname's parents stepped through the isolation bay door. Mizuki had met them, albeit briefly, once before. She recognized Miranda Sterling, her green hair braided as usual, and her husband Thade, who had his long, wavy blonde hair tied back in a ponytail. Privately, she thought he looked a lot more yummy with it loose around his back and shoulders, like it had been at the last year's parent-teacher open house. but when she'd expressed that opinion to Kaname, the latter had threatened to hit her with the largest item at hand at the time, a laptop computer, so she resolved to keep such opinions to herself this time around. Accompanying them was another person, a woman that Mizuki didn't recognize. She assumed that she was a doctor, if the crisp white lab coat was any indication. But very few doctors in her experience tended to wear a short, tight skirt with what appeared to be a one-piece racing swimsuit and black stockings underneath. There was nothing unprofessional about the woman's expression, however. She took Bashir's diagnostic datapad from his hand as if he were there specifically to hold it for her, scanned it briskly, and handed it back, then said, "Good, the stories were true. You do have half a brain. The name's Lina. I'm Miss Sterling's physician of record." She stepped to Kaname's bedside, reached down to take her pulse, then glanced up at the baffled Starfleet medico with an expression that fell just short of, "Are you still here?" and asked, "Yes?" Bashir gaped at her for a moment, though Mizuki couldn't tell for sure whether he'd been thrown more off balance by her brusqueness or her looks. Then he recovered himself, and said with an air of slightly frosty, wounded dignity, "I trust you'll find everything in order, Dr. Lina. We may not have a great deal of experience treating patients of Miss Sterling's specific background here, but this facility is on the very cutting edge of xenomedicine. I did say you appeared to live up to your reputation," Lina told him coolly. "And now, if you would excuse us, Dr. Bashir, I must consult with my patient and her parents. Confidentiality, you understand. However, I will ensure that you are forwarded all the appropriate information for her further treatment, should it become necessary. Good day." Bashir regarded her with a look of mingled indignation and appreciation for a moment, then nodded stiffly and absented himself. Almost immediately, to Mizuki's surprise, but not to Kaname's or her parents', she noticed, Lina's body language shifted from that of a hard-ass medical professional to something more down-home, and Mizuki, an accomplished actress herself, realized that the entire coolly dismissive professional thing was an act, a consummate performance for the benefit of Babylon 6's chief medical officer and no one else. "Did you really need to rake Dr. Bashir over the coals like that, Aunt Lina?" Kaname asked, a trifle sternly. "He's only trying to help." Lina sighed, a wry smile crossing her face as she moved over to the side of the bed to give Kaname a seated hug. "I know, dear, but the man has a reputation for more than just competence. If I'd once given him the slightest opportunity to start asking questions, we'd never have gotten rid of him." She shook her head. "The cutting edge of xenomedicine, indeed." "All the same, that was pretty harsh. I mean, he means well. And everyone says he's a great doctor." "I suppose I may have been a little too hard on him," Lina admitted with a sigh. "But I wanted to get straight to work, and I couldn't do it with him hovering around. You're right, though. I'll see about making it up to him later," she promised. "I would like to state for the record that I am in awe of your acting skills, Dr. Lina," Mizuki stated, clearly impressed. Lina smiled at the blonde teen. "Please, just call me Lina. Any friend of Kaname's is practically family, as far as I care." She then turned and shifted her focus to Kaname, pulling a tricorder out of her lab coat pocket and performing several scans. "So, now that Doc Bashir's out of the room, can you explain to me what's up with Kaname?" Mizuki asked, concerned. Lina paused in her examinations and gave Kaname a thoughtful, questioning glance. Kaname considered for a moment and then nodded back to her doctor. "All right. Since Kaname's informed me that you know some of what she is already, I'll tell you. However, I would prefer it if you don't spread what you learn around. While it's not classified, and I've written several medical journal articles on the subject, it's not exactly common knowledge, and we'd prefer to keep it that way." "You got it. I know that Kaname is a quarter Meltrandi and half Invid, but I'd never even heard of the latter species until I'd actually met her and we got to talking.
I'm not surprised. There's not very many of us in the galaxy right now, no matter how long and hard Ariel has been working to correct that.
At least it's better than it was in the old days, Miranda interjected, patting her husband's hand.
This is true, Liner replied with a smile. Anyway, to put it simply, we Invid aren't telepathic with other species. But among ourselves, there's a subliminal connection, a mind link, between all Invid across the galaxy. No matter our origin, no matter how far apart we are, we all share in it, though its strength is variable, dependent on a number of factors. For most of us, it's been a constant presence in our entire lives. Every Invid grows up with it, learns to use it, adapts to be able to tune it out or even block it if they want privacy.
But Kaname sighed. My connection is screwy, which I'm pretty sure isn't a medical term, and the neuroshock didn't help matters any.
Lina nodded. It effectively deranged Kaname's connection to such a degree that immediate recovery would not have been possible without an outside source of assistance to provide a baseline purge and reset. Like, say, a starship with a sizable proportion of Invid crew aboard.
Oh.
Misuki looked thoughtful as she tried to digest all this new information about her friend.
So what you're saying, in effect, was that her mental cell phone reception was crap, and it took an outside source to force a reconnect?
Not quite, but that's a good enough analogy for now. And as for you, young lady, Lina said, pointing at Konami's forehead, I understand and sympathize with one of the reasons you came to Satori Mandeville in the first place, but if you want to prevent incidents like that network noise from happening again, you are going to have to begin some serious mental exercises. Right now, your connection to the mind link is still woefully underdeveloped, especially for somebody of your age.
Most Invid my age had full access before they were even uplifted, Aunt Lina,
Kaname protested. And they're adults by now.
That still doesn't change the fact that you need to strengthen your mind, if at least just to have the skill to perform blocking when you don't want stray thoughts from the rest of us.
Kaname sighed, defeated, and leaned back on her pillows.
All right, all right. Give me a regimen to follow and I'll get right on it, because I didn't already have enough to do.
She grumbled in a lower voice. Then she looked past the doctor at her parents, gave a wry smile, and said,
So, how are things?
Miranda returned her daughter's wry smile and said, Well, I feel better now that I've seen you're all right. At least I think my heart started beating normally again. Your Aunt Maya, on the other hand, is two steps short of apoplectic. Miranda grimaced. On the way down, I briefly heard her threaten to go down into Brown 21 to cleanse the place by herself, and to be honest, I don't know if I could bring myself to stop her.
Korgu is much the same, regrettably, Lina added. He's been all but clawing the walls ever since the first aftershocks got through the mind link. Lieutenant Mao has him currently confined to the gymnasium so he doesn't do too much property damage.
Fortunately for us all, Chief Garibaldi gave us a quick briefing on the situation on the way down here. So, as much as it may disappoint Maya and Korg, we'll have to forgo the scouring of the sector today, Thade dryly commented from where he stood with his hands crossed, leaning against the wall. For which I think we all have cause to be thankful.
Speak for yourself, Dad, Kaname muttered.
Well, at the very least, we can be thankful for the sergeant here. Lina and Miranda blinked at Thade, then again at the person toward whom he was directing the smile. Kaname and Mizuki turned to look as well, and were surprised to find that Sosuke had gotten to his feet at some point while none of them was looking at him, and was now standing next to Kaname's bed at a rigid parade rest. Now, with Miranda's eyes upon him, he came to attention and saluted her crisply.
Sergeant Sosuke Sagara, TACCOM Security Solutions,
he said. It's an honor to finally meet you, Commander.
Miranda was at a loss for a moment, then, it seemed only sporting, returned his salute.
At ease, Sergeant.
Sosuke returned to parade rest, his arms folded behind his back.
So you're our international man of mystery.
Sosuke looked puzzled.
Ma'am?
Never mind. I understand you've been looking out for Kaname for some time. Is this the first time you've had to take serious action?
Affirmative, Commander, Sosuke replied. Previous incidents have all been false alarms or misunderstandings. This was our first Alpha crisis.
Reddening slightly, he corrected himself. That is to say, my first since receiving this assignment.
Thade tisked slightly, shaking his head. Kaname, 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 he chided his daughter. Didn't your mother and I raise you better than that?
Now it was Kaname's turn to look puzzled.
Come again?
You know very well, Thade told her gravely, you're not supposed to let a boy fight an entire gang for you until the third date, at least.
Kaname went very red.
Dad! She protested. You call that a date?
Don't rile the poor girl up, you, Miranda told her husband. She's had a long enough day as it is.
I'm fine, Mom, Kaname told her. Then, giving her father a reproachful look, she added, a date, indeed.
Thade smiled an inscrutable smile and said, your mother and I have had stranger, but that's probably a story for another time.
You bet it is, Miranda agreed.
Well, we'll get out of your hair, Kaname, said Lina, putting away her tricorder. As it happens, I agree with your own assessment. You're fine. But no doubt Bashir will want to keep you around a little while longer for observation. And loath as I am to admit it, this is his med lab.
She shrugged.
I'll work up a set of mental exercises for you. In the meantime, you might as well try to get some more sleep.
Kaname opened her mouth to reply, then closed it again as the repetitive cycle of stock footage and talking heads that had been running silently on the TV since she awoke suddenly changed.
Blinking, she gestured to Mizuki, who had the remote, and said,
"Turn it up!"
Communications blackout of the Tau Ceti system has just been lifted. Avalon 17's famous virtual anchorwoman, Ray Tracy, was saying below a bright red breaking news banner that had just splashed onto the screen and drawn Kaname's attention. We take you now live and direct to John Trussell. The screen changed to a view, initially very confusing, of a space battle in progress. A Network 23 News with John Trussell graphic in the lower right corner identified the scene as a live feed from the media starship Swordbreaker, timecode 0334 GST.
Thank you, Ray, said the instantly identifiable voice of Truss. We're live and direct in the Tau Ceti system, just outside the orbit of Tau Ceti 4's single moon, where a combined task group of the International Police Space Force and the Wedge Defense Force has been fighting a pitched battle with the Earth Force Navy's Tau Ceti invasion fleet for the better part of an hour. The joint task force, codenamed Task Force Trident, under the overall command of IPSF Commodore Utena Tenjo, has just captured the ship responsible for the communications blackout Earth Force has imposed on this system since about 10 o'clock yesterday morning. With that ship in IPO hands, we were able to enter the system and begin transmitting these pictures to you. It's difficult to say exactly what's happening right now. The battle is very chaotic, doubly so as a Confederate Free Spacer squadron arrived to reinforce the IPO WDF group just before we got here. Based on my own experience as a WDF officer, though, I would say that Task Force Trident has the upper hand here, and I'm told that a surface assault is already underway.
Trussell paused, panning the Swordbreaker's camera across the battlefield. Already, the ship's sophisticated scanning and tracking systems were painting identification markers and other clarifying indicators over the scene, helping him make sense of it for himself and his viewers. Then he resumed his narration, breaking the action down piece by piece and methodically making it all intelligible, despite the chaotic sprawl it seemed to be at first glance.
"There's the Prometheus," Kaname cried, pointing. "Aunt Comey and Aunt Terry are there?"
Miranda nodded, smiling. "And I'm sure Earthforce had no idea what was about to hit them," she said. "After all, what can one old Hawkbat-class carrier do?"
"Besides that," Thade added with a note of dark satisfaction, as, in one corner of the screen, a magnified inset showed the Prometheus's wing of Astro Fortress space bombers scoring several direct hits on one of the Earth Force battlegroup's destroyer escorts.
"Okay, so much for what I said about getting some more sleep," said Lina.
"0621 hours GST, 5:21 a.m. Tau City time. Operation Trident mission elapsed time, 0421. Tau City 4. It would have been stretching the point beyond a point's tensile yield strength to say that getting the upper hand in orbit had been the easy part. Utena Tenjo was not the kind of commander who would ever casually classify an operation that cost six of her spacers their lives as easy. But from her perspective, the space battle wasn't as grueling or as confusing as the ground ops that followed. There were so many different things going on dirtside that she had felt like one of those old-timey performers who kept plates spinning on poles since she arrived. Somehow she'd managed to pull off the first phase, with a lot of help from her friends. But there had been times when she felt that just one false step would bring the whole mess crashing down into an insoluble tangle. Case in point, preparations to move out from the beachhead at Tau City International Spaceport and commence the final, decisive assault on Government Plaza in the heart of the city. By the time she took the decision to make that move, she had people spread out all over the city, all with differing objectives and all at different stages of getting those objectives done, all converging on a single point. They all had to arrive at that point at roughly the same time, from the right directions, in the right numbers, or the big finale of the morning's hard work would fizzle rather than flash, and she'd be left, strategically speaking, holding a very big bag. As if reading her thoughts, Sergeant Pete Stacker of the Repo Men surveyed the Earth Force barricade at the end of the airport access road from their impromptu observation post at one corner of the spaceport's passenger concourse, currently marking the very fluid line between territory recaptured and territory still held, and muttered under his breath, "Those ODSTs don't make their IPs on time. We're all going to be left standing out here with our dick in our hand." A moment later, Stacker seemed to realize that he'd said that out loud. He cleared his throat, reddening, and said, sorry, ma'am." "I was just thinking the same thing," Utena replied without looking away from the enemy line, "only not quite so concisely." She glanced to her right, where the towering green-armored figure of Master Chief John Spartan formed a sort of reassuring bulwark. She thought she'd heard the Master Chief chuckle at the byplay between herself and Stacker, but she wasn't entirely sure. You could never be entirely sure about that kind of thing with the Master Chief. Cortana rezzed up from the little holocom unit built into the left vambrace of the Master Chief's Mjolnir armor, which made it look as if her 1/6 scale avatar were perched on his arm like a hunting bird. The thought made Utena smile as the AI told her, "Major Orman's people are on schedule, as is the 66th Legion. 131 SMF will be here in 4 minutes. Everybody else is holding position." She folded her holographic arms and smirked slightly. "Compared to making half the Klingon Navy fight the other half, keeping track of all this is easy." Utena laughed. "If only we could all have 10th order computer brains," she said. "Well, I'm not one of those AIs who like to go on and on about the inefficiency of the organic cerebrum," Cortana said, "but there are bionic neural implants available." "No, thank you.
Inefficient and squishy as it is, I'll keep what I've got.
Utrina's communicator beeped for her attention, then said, Kirk to Tenjo. She took it from her belt and flipped it open.
Go ahead, Admiral, she said.
Commodore, James T. Kirk's voice replied, there's been an interesting development up here. Northumberland and Bellerophon just left the system.
Utrina raised an eyebrow.
Just the Starfleet ships?
For the moment. Earth Force's task group is still out near Tau Ceti V's orbit. I think they're trying to regroup for a counterattack, but they're not making very much progress.
Wait one.
Utrina waited, noticing as she did that every eye in the command post was on her, or more accurately, on her communicator. A few unnaturally long moments later, Kirk's voice returned.
Correction. Now most of the Earth Force contingent is bugging out as well. Clytemnestra just opened a meta point and the whole task group exited through it, except the Marine assault ship and her remaining escort.
Well, that's damn peculiar, Utrina observed.
That's what I said, Kirk replied, sounding mildly amused. Despite his youthful appearance, Kirk was an old space dog of the pre-WDF Reformation era. But if it bothered him to be subordinated to a young woman in her early 20s, one whom he technically outranked, he didn't show it. Rather, he seemed oddly tickled whenever they proved to be of the same mind, which had happened quite a few times so far tonight.
They could be forming up with a larger counterstrike force just arriving outside the system, Utrina said.
Possibly, Kirk agreed. Though if that's the case, I can't think why the Starfleet ships left, or why they left the Suribachi behind. My instincts tell me something stranger than that is going on, but I can't put my finger on what.
With your permission, he said, and again there wasn't a trace of irony in his tone, I intend to keep the fleet at red alert and redeploy in an outward defensive formation, in case that is what they're up to.
Sounds good to me, Utrina said, too preoccupied with the situation to be self-conscious. Task Unicorn, Illustrious, and Charlemagne to cover the more heavily damaged ships, and send Whippet, Assailant, Valiant, and Scimitar to run Pattern Theta patrols.
Commodore, said Kirk with an air of satisfaction, you read my mind. I'll comm you if anything new develops. Kirk out.
Utrina closed her communicator, put it away, and regarded her onlookers with a thoughtful look.
Thoughts?
The Master Chief grunted.
Probably just cut and ran, he said.
Typical swabbies, Stacker remarked, taking the opportunity to needle the Spartan, whose title was a naval rating.
Take any excuse they get to leave the Marines in the lurch.
Before the Master Chief had a chance to take or leave that bait, one of the Valkyrie, faceless in her visored, red-striped black armor, dropped lightly into their impromptu observation post through the shell hole in the roof. Straightening, she crossed Utrina's position with brisk but unhurried strides and saluted. A moment later, her helmet deconstructed, its components stowing themselves fractally away into the suit's collar, revealing herself to be a violet-eyed, black-haired woman with no facial marks.
Our teams are in position, Commodore, she reported with a smile. General Ravenhair sent me to mediate comms in case they get their broadcast jamming up again.
Utrina grinned and remarked with faint, good-natured exasperation, Jin, if any more of my ground commanders find excuses to send me bodyguards, I'll have everybody over here, and nobody will be left to fight the bad guys.
Guilty, Virginia Shepherd replied cheerfully.
Well, stick around, Utrina conceded. We might need that rifle of yours before we're through here.
Aye, aye, Commodore.
Shepard saluted again, and then, still grinning, turned and looked up at the towering Spartan next to her.
Hey, John. Long time.
The Master Chief glanced down at her, but if he was surprised to see her, he gave no sign, just nodded cordially and replied,
Shepard.
Facing front again, he added conversationally,
Heard you were dead.
Shepard shrugged. I got better. Thought the same about you, though. The Master Chief gave a dry chuckle.
Spartans don't get killed, he said. We just go MIA sometimes.
Cortana looked up as if listening to something the others couldn't hear, then said, Commodore, Major Orman's people in the 66th, they're at their IPs, and the rest of 131 SMF is arriving now. I've got your entry options mapped, and we'll be ready for final briefing in 2.
Guess I'd better go over the map one more time, then, said Utena. Calm me if they move.
Aye, aye, ma'am, Stacker acknowledged, and Utena crossed the dozen yards or so of tarmac between the OP and the main operations tent, where the holotank and whatnot were set up. A few moments later, a pair of blue Tactiv warthogs arrived with the rest of Stacker's squad.
Hold on, said the Master Chief as Stacker went to greet them.
He raised his S2AM sniper rifle and peered through the scope.
We've got movement.
Stacker paused, raising his electro-binoculars.
The hell's going on out there? He mused. Looks like a civilian car just ran that roadblock.
The Master Chief lowered his rifle.
It's the Stig. Looks like we don't have to send a rescue party after the Top Gear guys after all.
Stacker grinned.
Well, hot damn, he said, and ran toward the lead warthog. Get your ass out of that seat, Mendoza, I'm driving, he said.
Why do you get to drive all of a sudden? Mendoza asked.
Because I am your goddamn sergeant, and you will do as you're told,
Stacker barked in his not entirely serious bark. Mendoza made a great show of feeling oppressed as he yielded the driver's seat, and with a battle roar from Tunzer at the chain gun, the hog peeled out to go to the Stig's rescue.